Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is A Lot to Learn with Austin Rogers. For the guy who knows everything, he's still got a lot to learn. Without further ado, here's Austin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. I have no idea what time it is because it is a podcast and people listen to podcasts whenever they listen to podcasts. They might be sitting on the side of the Hudson River in beautiful Beacon, New York with famed contemporary artist Ron English. Ron, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We are in Ron's lovely home upon a bluff in Beacon, New York, overlooking the Hudson River. And I didn't even think I was going to start about that. But the Hudson River School, right? The Thomas Coles of the world. What is it about the Hudson?
I don't know, but it's very beautiful up here. If you're from somewhere else, it probably seems doubly beautiful. I remember like maybe the first week or so I was up here, my kid was playing soccer and there was a spectacular sunset in the mountains and everybody here was kind of ignoring it, watching the soccer game. And I thought, man, you guys should just turn around for a minute. But I guess you can get used to anything, even beauty, right?
That's the eye of the artist. Go on Ron's Instagram. We're going to start this right off with that. Ron, what is your Instagram?
Ron English Art.
Go to Ron English Art right now. Take a couple seconds. Flip through some of the stuff so you guys are grounded on what we're about to discuss. Because Ron is a consummate pop culture artist, but do you like the term pop culture artist?
Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, as long as you call me an artist, I'm fine with it. Anything else you throw in there? Street artist,
pop culture.
Bad artist, yeah. But artist is an interesting thing because it's kind of like a compliment. Like if you were a plumber and I said, yeah, he's a plumber, but he's really an artist. You know, that's a high compliment. So the name of your profession is actually a compliment.
Right. And to have, yeah, artist is sort of an application to other careers, like, oh no, yeah, he's an electrician, but he is an artist at it. But you are just an artist. Not many people can say that. Where what's the origin of just what's the what?
Actually, quite a lot of people seem to be able to say that. So,
oh well, yeah. Seem to be able
if
to
you
say
can
that.
Hold a crayon in your hand and hang out at a cafe in Brooklyn, you're an artist, right?
when was the exact moment where you're like, oh, I am now Ron English, the artist, not Ron English, the aspiring artist, not Ron English. Is it a mindset? Is it there's a clear demarcation? Was there, I sold that one piece and that's what made it?
Yeah, I think I just liked it a lot and I kind of was shy. So it was a thing to retreat into. You'll find probably most artists you talk to started off pretty shy and they needed to express themselves in some way. But I think you do something, like if I was a professional clown, I would think about all the things that kind of led me to that. Oh, I remember I loved Lon Chaney and I loved makeup and I remember going to the circus and, you know, and seeing the sideshows and, you know, being intrigued by the whole mystery of everything. And, you know, I would tell a narrative that told all these things that led me to being a clown. So I think no matter what you are, you kind of go back to your life and find things that kind of led you in that direction.
Well, you've got a little bit of circus in you.
Yeah.
You've got a little bit of Three Wings Ring Circus. We'll post some photos on Twitter and Instagram of Ron's home studio because it's full of bright vibrancy and just craziness. And I love it. I love it. I love it to death. What was your sideshow? What was your Lon Chaney? What was your makeup artist that you saw as a young adult or a child that drove you into the direction towards this sort of ethos?
Well, I liked comic books. I liked art. I liked toys. I think probably what actually drove me is just being rewarded for the behavior. So like when all the cousins would come over, we would get under my grandmother's table and I would draw them pictures. So it was something I got rewarded for. And I think that's a lot of people's story is if you do something early in life and you get a lot of acclamation for it, then you kind of gravitate towards it.
So you're encouraging our children to act up.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I drew on my sister's wall and then I blamed it on her, but unfortunately, I used words, and she was only two.
And I'm sure your parents saw it and said, that's way too good for the two-year-old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I couldn't sort out at the time, like, how'd they know that she didn't do it, and I did it. I wasn't that bright, you know.
Right, right. But clearly, there was something.
She was, like, 5 years younger than me, so.
What informs your art? Because you are consuming pop culture and reforming it and representing it, not representing it, but representing it, and you're consuming it at a breakneck pace. Like, where does it all come from? Are you on the internet all the time? Are you on the TV all the time? Where are you getting all of your incredibly well-informed takes?
You know, maybe it started when I was a kid, and my mom wanted to show me how to draw, so she showed me how to draw, like, Charlie Brown and Snoopy, and then, you know, then it was exciting, but you can't really, you know, you're not supposed to draw this, you're supposed to draw your own thing, and it's kind of illegal to, you know, draw it or whatever and present it, so kind of, I think it stuck in my mind that, you know, I wanted to make art about what it's like to be alive now, and we're living in this huge media culture, and we're looking at media 24/10. So, like, what's it like to be a person that's absorbing this media? Because you're not going to remember it the right way, or you're not going to take it the way it was intended. So it's kind of like I create, like, the unintentional aftermath of what it's like to absorb all this information.
Okay, I think I get it. Okay. So you're consuming, and then you're sort of presenting towards the viewer their sort of misconceived memory of what these things are. Like the I love the what's the name of your bloated Tony the Tiger?
Oh, Fat Tony.
Fat Tony. Yeah. Duh, Fat Tony.
But, so but we, some of that kind of stuff is just easy because, you know, you get presented this stuff when you're a kid. It's a cartoon. It's has a prize in the cereal, and you love the cereal. And later it has a lot of ill effects on your life. And then you kind of think, well, what? They have all these iconic characters that are presenting the, you know, they're cartoons, so they're not going to get fat or they're not going to get old. But what would it be like if they actually were, you know, semi-human and had to eat the cereal, and what would they end up looking like, and what would their life be like?
And so, you're Ronald McDonald, same right. Way. What would happen if Ronald McDonald, the ever young, I believe he's been shelved by McDonald's. I haven't seen him around in a while.
He's still around. He's still pretty healthy.
But he's still healthy. But
I think, you know, with the Marlboro man, you know, they said you have to smoke cigarettes, and I think everybody at the company had to smoke the cigarettes, but we want you to be seen in public. You're famous. You're the Marlboro man. We want you to always be smoking our cigarettes, you know, and then he got emphysema and he had to get an iron lung. And I think that maybe McDonald's kind of came after that and thought maybe we probably shouldn't have our guy eating the food, you know, because it could turn out badly. Yeah. They probably have in his contract he can't eat there.
Right, right. And he, Tony the Tiger, obviously, he doesn't have to deal with that because he never grows old and he's always great. It's like beer commercials. They pop the beer, they give each other cheers, but not once will that beer ever touch your lips on a beer commercial, right? I don't think I've ever seen Ronald McDonald be like, yum, 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 it's always fun, 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 come in here, kids. And I don't think I've ever seen Ronald McDonald take a bite out of a double quarter pounder.
No, and I've never seen a beer advertised as like, you know, you'll probably have less of a hangover drinking this beer. You know, we're one of the best for the hangover thing, you know, or even saying, you know, this beer makes great hangovers and embarrassing moments.
This is the fun for right now, not the fun for right later.
Wouldn't it be interesting if you could have the hangover first? I wonder if you'd even drink, you know.
I don't really get them, so I'm pretty okay in that.
How do you not get them?
Probably genetics, since my parents are right here, and they they tipple sometimes. It looks like it rubbed off on me. Can't say the same for my brothers, because their entire lives are hangovers. They won't listen to this, so it doesn't matter.
Now, I remember talking to my uncle saying, you know, I just got this hangover, and it lasted a whole day. And they're like, ha. Yeah, we have hangovers the last 3 days.
So. I guess I got the genetic code on that one. You go out there and you sort of, you know, you stick it to the man a little bit. Does the man stick it back? Because you are treading on some really, like, I see Disney, I see Fox, I see Warner, I see every major media conglomerate represented in your art. Do they ever slap back at you?
Sometimes. I mean, we have lawsuits, but not in the ones you think. I mean, McDonald's never did anything. Why? I don't know. I don't ask them. I don't know. I don't sit in those meetings. I know that there was the first time that I had done MC Supersize, the Fat Ronald, whatever, for years, but he really got famous when he appeared in Supersize Me, the movie. And I thought that movie would probably, you know, get a lawsuit from McDonald's. But the year before, there was another movie, and it was about a lawsuit in England where it didn't really turn out that well. Basically, these young agitators were handing out flyers that said all these derogatory things about McDonald's that all happened to be true. But they took them to court, and I think the court case really didn't play out the way they had intended, McDonald's. And so they probably thought it's better just to, you know, how many billboards can this guy really do, you know? I mean, it's better just to leave this stuff alone instead of blowing it up into something bigger.
The Streisand effect, where you call attention to something that you wanted to keep secret, and thus the internet being full of miscreants and probably white supremacists, blow it out of the water with, like, Barbara Streisand wanted to hide the location of her house from, like, paparazzi, so she filed, like, some privacy claim, and of course then... Now the address of her house is published because she put it in court. It's whenever someone tries to, like, squelch something, like, never delete a tweet, because The second you delete it, it calls to attention that you deleted it.
Huh. Well, I did have a meeting with one of the guys from one of the big billboard companies, and that was just kind of a weird thing because I had been out all night with Shepard Fairey doing billboards, and I was always very open about I do these illegal billboards, and, you know, and I was on a morning radio show in L.A. And even my manager called me and goes, you know, quit implicating yourself in crimes on radio. But my attitude was like, well, I'm in the phone book. They know me, you know. It's like they could find me if they wanted to. I write my name on the billboard. But, the guy was in the same building. So he came running up after the radio show and, you know, grabbed me. And, you know, so I've been looking for you for 15 years. And it's like...
No, you haven't.
Yeah, no, you haven't. Because I'm in the phone book and I'm not that hard to find. It's like, why don't you tell me what's really going on? And he finally said, look, you know, I take my clients to see a billboard and then your stupid stuff's on there and it's embarrassing. And I, you know, and even at one point said, look, I'll give you free billboards if you just quit doing it. But the reason I don't come after you is because I don't want the narrative to be this hero of, you know, consumer culture hero or whatever, you know. We took them down, and then we were the bad guys. I don't want the narrative where we're the bad guys. And it just shows you they don't completely control the narrative. They just own all the billboards.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Did you take the free billboards?
I said, well, you're going to tell me you're going to control where they are, and you're going to control, more importantly, what I put on them. And he goes, well, of course. And
then,
like,
no,
we don't have a deal.
So then then it's actually not free.
Right.
It is not free at all. Yeah. You are paying.
Well, I think that at one point, you know, I'd done the billboards for years and I was doing a little better. So I thought, you know, maybe instead of just laying awake all the time wondering when they're going to come get me, maybe I could just rent the billboards and then, you know, it would cost me more money than stealing them. But at the same time, I could probably sleep at night, you know, and not wonder if I'm going to get arrested. But then I kind of found out, like, contacting the billboard companies, that they really don't accept a lot of concepts, you know. Like, they said, well, you can support the war, but you can't protest the war. You can support marriage, but you can't support gay marriage. Or, do you know what I mean? They're very strict in what
right.
you can say on their billboards.
Right.
Like, I can't make fun of McDonald's on their billboard, you know, because they take billions of dollars worth of advertising from them. And so I'm going to do three billboards. And yeah, it's just,
and
I didn't realize how restrictive they actually were. People think you can just rent a billboard and say whatever you want, but that's not the case. You can say kind of commercial speech, or you can have a right-wing agenda. And if it's because it matches with their agenda, then you can do that.
But you can't have a left-wing agenda.
Yeah, there was a famous case, and I wish I remembered it better. But this group got together, wanted to protest the war, the first Gulf War, and they took out a huge ad on Times Square. And I think they didn't read the fine print, but they rounded up $1 million, bought this billboard that said stop the war or whatever. And then they wouldn't put the billboard up, and then they wouldn't give them their money back. And they said, well, you should read your contract, because it says we're allowed to censor you. And if we decide, you know, you've paid for this billboard and you want to put up this billboard, and we decide we don't like what you're saying, then we're going to nix it, but we don't have to give you your money back. You know, so it was a weird case.
Yeah, I remember in Times Square, We've had a couple Gulf Wars now. I remember in Times Square, well, I remember in the Vietnam War, John and Yoko put up a War Is Over. And in the first Gulf War in Times Square, they put up a War Is Over billboard. And Yoko put up in the second Gulf War, I remember that in Times Square, a War Is Over billboard too. Dead center, like 49th or 50th Street. Wonder how she got away with it.
I don't know. I don't know her, so.
No, I mean, it was just a wondering out loud. Maybe that's a favorable billboard company, or maybe that was the realtor of the building owns the ad space and they were fine with it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. There's only a couple billboard companies, though.
So. Yeah. Well,
there used to be a lot more, so probably back then they were about 20 and now there's about two. So.
Yeah, CBS Outdoor. Wait, why are we going, what are we doing? We're now on a primer of the billboard industry. We're now a senior marketing agent for Viacom Outdoors. Let's bring back to the art. So we've got Mickey Mouse, we've got a fat Mickey, we've got Mickey in the gas mask. What's that?
It's kind of like he's breathing the pop culture, so he needs his mask. And his name is Mouse Mask Murphy, so, and that's another reason I don't get sued, because he's altered 30%. He's a parody and he has a different name, so...
You've really thought this through. Because, I mean...
I could have a second career as a copyright attorney, right?
Right, because you're figuring out... Oh, so you said altered 30%, different name, and it's parody. What are the 30% alterations that you've marked?
Well, I guess it's just the gas mask deforms his whole face into something else.
All right, and that's a good 30% of a mouse.
And interestingly... I think the Israelis made a gas mask for kids that looked like Mickey Mouse, because it kind of looks like Mickey Mouse, a gas mask. But that way, when they were getting air raids, it didn't freak the kids out as much as like, oh, we're all going to dress like Mickey, instead of like, we're all going to die. Or we're not going to die because we're going to wear these masks.
Right.
But I think it made it more like a game for them that it looked like Mickey Mouse.
So that's actually... good, because there was something I wanted to talk about. A couple years back, I went to your Guernica opening across the street from the Whitney in Soho. And Guernica is one of my favorite paintings of all time. And it's one of the most important paintings of all time. I know this, you know this. But for our listeners, let's talk about Guernica first, what it means to us. And then let's talk about Guernica's influence in the wider scope of things. And let's talk about how you turned Guernica on its head. I don't remember the first time I ever saw Guernica, because I've never seen the real one, but I've definitely seen the one, the replication and the United Nations, and I've seen it in my art history books. I don't remember the first time I've seen it, but I remember every time I see it. Hmm. You know what I mean? It always punches. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about tell us a little bit about the history of Guernica, if you know, and what it sort of means to you.
Well, he painted it for the
Pablo Picasso, by the way, painted Guernica, in case you're
Spanish Pavilion. But so it was almost, I guess, a commission, and I think he wanted to use that moment to make a statement. You know, to me, it was kind of like it was like Ring Around the Rosie, where it's like it's already a degree of separation from what it's actually talking about, because it is cartoon, you know, so it's not. Like, there's this horrific event, and if you took pictures of it, you might be mortified to look at it, because, you know, little kids with their heads blown off or whatever. But no, it's already a cartoon, so it's already there's a distancing from it, which is something I think humans have to do. You can't take on horror on a daily basis. You have to kind of turn it into a kid's song, or you have to take some kind of distance from it, you know. And I think that what I did is just kind of used it as a template, because, again, everybody knows it. And as soon as you arrange characters in that position, people know that's Guernica. So you have this underlying concept, and then whatever you superimpose on top of it still has that embedded meaning of the original painting.
Right. The mother is screaming at the sky, but she's grotesque, a caricature. There's the debilitated horse who was bombed in the streets, again screaming at the sky, but it's a grotesque cartoon. You're right. So,
but it's so stylistic that you can't forget it.
Right.
You know, had he made a photorealistic painting of a bomb blowing up kids, then we wouldn't still be talking about it, because it can't exist iconically in your head.
Right. Way. And then in that case, then you just move on to, is in essence, photography. You've got, yeah. We've got Napalm Girl. We've got the Saigon police chief executing that Viet Cong on the street. We've got those graphic photos.
But it's probably not that different than what we were talking about with the mascots for companies. It's like, you know, it's easier to remember. You know, it's a spokesperson that never dies. It stays the same. You know, so the painting stays the same, and it's a cartoon. It's easy to remember.
It is, and it is. It's sort of the icon of 20th century war.
Yeah. And it's weird because you can't really tell what's going on. I mean, to me, it was enlightening to go see it in person and see all the sketches, because like the guy on the far right, or maybe it's a woman. I can't tell. I think maybe it's a woman, but it's hard to tell like what's going on with her. Why does she have tiny little feet? Why are they sticking off to the side? But when you watch the progress of him painting it, originally she was falling off a building, off a ladder. Then he just painted that stuff out, and I guess for the composition. And so it's interesting, like the weird stuff, there's just some stray feet sticking out. Where are they coming from? But, you know, watching him paint it and change it, I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, you are right. You can look at Guernica and you can see that it's something terrifying, but you still have to be informed of the actual event, which was the 1936, the German Condor Legion bombed a rebellious Spanish Civil War town into submission. Modern airplanes, carpet bombing a civilian population for, if not the first time, the first effective time. And that was what... That's what Picasso was drawing. But yeah, you have to be informed of that event to understand beyond the terror. We see the terror, but we have to be informed of the event to be beyond the terror. And I guess that sort of circles back to where you are, because you have to be informed of Guernica to be informed of your takes on Guernica.
Right. But also, I think, you know, for me, it was kind of like, a tradition in folk music is that you just steal a melody. I mean, a melody's for everybody, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm going to write more contemporary songs about maybe something that's going on right now. And nobody thought a thing about that because, you know, the idea of ownership was different, like, with that art form. And then I think there's a weird thing with art, you know, and the idea of ownership and what do you own and what can you just take from somebody else and use. Like, a lot of that was in the air, and especially, like, in the 80s when I started painting Guernica, it was like people were sampling and stuff. So to me, it was interesting, like now I go to China a lot and they don't think about originality. If I can make a better Rembrandt than Rembrandt, then it's better. But, you know, an American would say, no, that's a copy. That's not as good, you know, even if it's slightly better. I don't know. But I mean, all this stuff's a concept, and we have to buy into the concept of originality or this is the, I look like they think that maybe Blue Poles, Jackson Pollock, maybe one of the greatest paintings, one of the greatest moments in Western civilization, you know, a pinnacle moment. I could make that painting, or I could make something so similar by using the same paint, but it would be considered worthless. Why? Because aesthetically, it was considered a height of creation, but nobody else can do it. You know, it would be like in another world, like if I made a Porsche, you know, and I used all the same parts and I built it in my backyard, but it's still a Porsche and it goes just as fast and... But it would have no value, you know, if it was art, because it's like, well, it's not an original, you know, but it's a copy that's exactly the same and it does all the functions exactly the same.
Yeah. I mean,
but that's something that's a prejudice that exists inside the art world that doesn't exist necessarily outside the art world. So I love like concepts of like that. What is originality? There was a guy in the 80s who just repainted Picasso's, Mike Bidlow. And it was like, you didn't look at the painting the same way because, you know, his intentionality behind making that painting still exists, because we know Mike Bidlow made that. Picasso didn't make it, even though they look alike. Now, Picasso made it for a certain reason, but Bidlow didn't make it for that same reason. You know, so, you know, the idea of the artist informs the art. The context of the creation of the art, you can't eradicate from the art. So, and I mean, to me, that's all interesting. You know,
it's interesting. Two, it pretty much, you know, validates anyone's efforts, you know. If you make the effort and you do, I don't see a problem with making a 100% copy of a Van Gogh.
Yeah,
you know,
in the 80s, they were playing with the idea of in-game art. Like, I want the art world to end with me. I want to make the pinnacle of art, and there's nowhere to go. I've intellectually in-gamed it, this thing. So, like, by like somebody like Sherry Levine or Mike, like, if I just recreate somebody else's art, like, where do you grow from this branch? I've just created a branch that you can't grow anything from. But, you know, and... But they've killed the idea of originality, but they haven't, because they're still original even if they copy, because, you know, again, the context around it and the way we look at it is different.
The act,
so it's
of
impossible
copy.
Not to be creative.
Right. The act of the copy, yeah, is the creative mind jump from going from I want to create something new to I want to do what someone else did better. And that's a logical leap that might not be evident to the viewer, but to the artist, that is the click. That's the
right.
click.
Or I just want to question why that's a venerated object and I can create the exact same object out of the same materials and it's worthless. You know, why do we think that? You know, so maybe I want to challenge that idea. I don't know.
Or conversely, we take the urinal, we turn it on the sideways, we write our mutt on it, and now it's worth something. You know, he did it
well,
sort
he
of
did it as a joke.
Yeah.
Then it became a venerated object of art history. So
right.
It's not a joke anymore.
No. Yeah. And then some kid came in and tried to smash it or something once, or one of the replicas. There's like four or five of them out there that are Duchamp certified, and some kid tried to come and smash it, and everyone's like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "That kid gets it."
Yeah.
That kid gets it by smashing that venerated object. That would be, Duchamp would be like,
right,
bravo, that yeah. kid gets it. But of course, the art world, oh, want to talk about the art world?
I don't know that much about the art world.
Do you try to stay out of that?
No. I mean, I understand how it functions and how it works, and it's interesting. I think it was interesting because I'm an art history major, so every time that I studied all these artists from other generations, like especially like the 20th century, it's like I always wonder who the other artists were, because we're only seeing a very small sliver of the pie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah, we know who Picasso is and we know who Matisse is, or but who else was making art and what were they making? And actually a very interesting thing happened to me. I lived in the East Village, and I lived in this old house on like Avenue D, and the woman that rented me like the basement, and later she actually let me rent the whole house, sweet lady.
Is it still open?
No. Well, some of the guys bought the house. But she had been an artist in the 50s. It kind of didn't work out for her. You know, I think her husband got killed by the crazy people in the neighborhood, and just, you know, she couldn't get into the art world. Maybe because she was a woman, and also because she wasn't making abstract expressionism. You know what she was making? She was making Keith Haring's. She was making these bubble-headed boys with no hands and like in bubble heads and with different colors and outlined by different colors and interlocking together and doing all the stuff with this imagery.
No way.
That later became, you know,
Keith Haring.
You know, I thought that was quite interesting. But, you know, if we look at it in our history book, we think of Helen Frankenthaler or Jackson Pollock or de Kooning, but we don't realize other people were doing completely different things, and they were rejected because they were a woman, or they were rejected because they weren't making the right kind of art for that moment. Clement Greenberg didn't approve, or whatever. But you know other people are making art, and most of it's going to get destroyed because there's no way to preserve it. Oh, she also had one other interesting thing. She had a catalog that from a show that she was in, and there was a guy that did an aquarium, like,
oh,
half,
no.
half full
oh,
of water.
Come on, really? She did it like a Damien Hirst?
No, that would be Jeff Koons. He floated the basketballs.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Fill the tank half full with like salt water and then float one or two or three basketballs. I guess maybe it's more expensive. You get three. I don't know. Or maybe it's too audacious to have three. It's better to have one. Except the only difference was that this artist had put the flotation tanks from the back of your toilet. He had screwed two together and had those floating. But it looked exactly like the Jeff Koons.
Right.
Half full and everything was just the same.
Oh, my God.
So you wondered. I wonder if he saw that. You know?
Yeah.
Well, I worked for another artist once, and we were kind of going through his files and stuff. And he had this kind of – he had about eight paintings that kind of hit it, like in the 80s. And we were going through like a catalog, and all those – really cool concepts. One of them's a guy's climbing a ladder and then it turns back around into another ladder and there's a guy climbing the other way and they kind of see each other. All the stuff he had stolen from the jewelry catalogs. It was somebody else's stuff. You know, if I hadn't went through his files, like, well, here's his source material. He just took somebody else's thing and then made it a painting instead of a piece of jewelry.
Instead of a piece of...
There it is, you know?
Oh my God. Wow. Yeah, that's...
But at the same time, it's like, it's weird because sometimes people get mad because you have an idea and then they'll have that idea. But I think if I have an idea right now, maybe 11 other people in the world are having the same idea at the same time, because we've all digested the same information and then we kind of come up with the same idea, and then whoever gets it out first, then
right.
it becomes
first,
their idea.
First to market wins.
Oh, it was interesting when the internet came out. Then I got a lot of, like years later, you know, a lot of people got really hostile with me because they were young and they came up with the concept of, hey, let's make Ronald Donald fat, or let's do the Last Supper with all these cartoon icons or whatever. And they would do it and they would be super happy. And then, you know, their friends would go like, oh, you're into Ron English. And they're like, I don't know who that is. And they honestly don't know who it is.
Of course.
Though they've done the same piece. And then, yeah, so one guy was so furious with me. He says, well, when did you do this piece? You know, and it's like, well, you done it. You did it in 2008. I did it in, you know, in the 80s. And it's like, oh, well, that doesn't count because that's before the internet. Nothing counts before the internet. So my piece was invalid because I created it before the internet.
Before they had a chance to. Yeah, you got to imagine how many people are in pre-internet isolated bubbles creating. There might be a Ron English doppelganger out there who was creating the same stuff in the 80s, but no one ever saw it because they gave up or they moved on or... How do you break through the white noise?
Yeah.
How did you break through the white noise?
Well, I mean, I went and put my stuff on Billboard. But then again, you still you
so
know,
act out. Yeah. So kids, act out and commit vandalism, and you'll.
Yeah. I've committed over 2,000 second degree felonies. You know. So I mean, it's hard to tell young kids. It's like I don't know. Just you know, most great fortunes are created by like. Criminals, and then the next generation, they don't maybe have to be a criminal, but if you look back, I mean Trump's fortune, his dad was a bit of a criminal. Kennedy's, their dad was a criminal. I mean, that's
not the Kennedys.
Okay, maybe not.
No, I'm joking. He was definitely the Kennedys. He was a bootlegger. It's fine. I mean, we our criminality, we used to crack open telephone exchange boxes and plug into them with stolen linemen's handsets and just call random countries and jack up people's phone bills. Not really as creative as creatively tagging a what was the other thing we did? We also took Radio Shack tone dialers and we took out one crystal and put in another crystal and it emulated the sound of a quarter. So when you dialed a number, it would say, please insert 50 cents. You go, and the phone would be tricked into thinking that 50 cents was put in.
Wow.
Again, not as creative as creatively tagging your billboard, but yeah, we've all got a little bit of criminal in us.
But the interesting thing with me is I never made money off of being a criminal. Most people are criminals to benefit themselves financially. You know, they'll rob somebody's house because they want the stuff to sell so they can buy some crack or whatever they do with the money. But I always just lost money off being a criminal, so I wasn't even a good criminal. Or I wasn't a good capitalist.
Yeah. Capitalist and criminal. There's a actually not fine line. It's pretty much the same thing.
But I actually got a job for the billboard company in the mid-80s. And I brought them my portfolio of billboards that I'd repainted, that I'd stolen. But I just took it was from another company. So, I used to work for Foster Kleiser. Maybe I could work for you guys. And like, you're really good at realism. We don't do a lot of realism. We do a lot of just cutting letters. You might be frustrated, but you're hired. You know? But I used the portfolio of your stolen
billboards.
And then I used their shop to create my billboards. Going on
to go on competitors' billboards.
Well, why did I want to work there? It's because they had like unlimited paint.
It's sort of like, why do I want to sweep the floor at the music studio?
Right.
Well, because I want to use the recording equipment at night after everyone's gone home. I think that's a pretty good modus operandi.
Yeah, but why did Shepard Fairey get a job at Kinko's? You know, it's like, so
did Shepard Fairey work at Kinko's?
I don't know if he did. I do remember like a funny thing that,
this is great, by the way. I'm loving this.
I used to go into Kinko's and like, and they would just, I would rack up a bill and then they would just go, you don't pay, bye. You know, and it's like, it was their way. It was kind of like that movie Fight Club where a lot of people were helping him just sort of quietly look, you know, and one guy even said, look, I can't get involved in the kind of stuff you do, but, you know, if I can help like by this way or that way, you know, quietly, I'll do it.
Yeah.
The greatest one was
a little secret fraternity.
The greatest one was I was doing all these anti-smoking billboards, mostly against Camel cigarettes, because they had kind of come up with a cartoon character because they realized, you know, that they'd lost the youth market. They were considered old man cigarettes. So they made a young Camel man, and that didn't work. And then they made a cartoon, and I think that might have been working. So I was doing I was making fun of those billboards a lot by having him be a little baby with the pacifier in one hand and a cigarette in the other. And then one day I get a call from them. And I'm thinking, okay, what's going on? Are they trying to buy me off? Because they say, well, you know, we'll give you like $100,000 or X amount of money to do all these billboards for us and, you know, and make these public appearances for us or whatever. And I didn't understand what's going on. I thought maybe they're just trying to, like, this is our quiet way to shut you up, you know. And I didn't know what to do. So my wife just says, well, take their money and use it to do your billboards. And for it was a while into it, and they did. It turned out they didn't know who I was, that they knew I was a downtown celebrity in Manhattan because I threw parties and stuff. Because they also got, like, Christopher Makos and stuff. I did a few of their billboards, but I put these trompe l'oeil things in them. Eventually, they stood underneath one of the billboards, saw all the skulls, and then fired me. But it turned out, like, that the person that brought me in from Chiat Day knew exactly who I was. And he said, look, I'm a... And later, I talked to him, and I said, what happened back then? And he goes, look, I was a 40-year-old gay man with a condo bill trying to make it, and I have this great job, and it's like, I don't want to sell cigarettes to kids. I didn't want to sell cigarettes to kids. But, you know, I couldn't let all this go, you know? I didn't have any backup plan. So when they gave me that assignment, I said, I'm just going to bring this guy Ron English in, and he's going to screw it up. He's going to make some kind of statement. And that's, so I knew who you were, and I brought you in because I was hoping you would do something like you did.
Wow. Wow.
It's interesting. So it was another, like, one of those Fight Club moments where there's somebody on the inside sort of helping you, you know?
Right. And that's sort of eye opening because, you know, you have people who work for the Koch brothers, you know, and work for, well, I think if you work for the Trump administration, you're just a terrible human. But there are probably good people, not in the Trump administration, but there are probably good people who work at these major borderline, they're not evil, they're just
well, you've worked
willfully,
really hard to get a job and you're scared and like, how am I going to get another job? I'm already this old, I'm not employable anymore. You know, like when I was first working here, we were selling something else, or, you know, it was exciting in a different way. I mean, I have a good friend that did.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Did that. He made Camel ads. And I said, what did you think when you were doing that? And he goes, I didn't think a thing about it. And he did say sometimes people walked off the job, says, I'm not selling cigarettes to kids or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And he just thought, well, that's weird. Huh. Well, I'll just get somebody else. But I mean, never thought about it for a minute. Now he's a political activist, so I think it finally hit him.
Right. And so, yeah, I guess some people will grow up and or some people will figure it out.
Or you just don't think about it. You just think, you know, hey, you know, because you think, like, if you told an actor you're going to do a Coke commercial, they're not going to say, I'm going to sell sugar water to, like, my federal citizens and she tried to get them diabetes and, you know, that's not good for you. They're not going to think that at all. They're going to think Coke is a big product. That's a big opportunity.
Yeah.
Me. You know, I am so happy. I'm calling my mom right now.
Yeah.
I'm on my way.
Yeah. And, I don't think anyone would think that deep into Coke either. Like, yeah, they think if someone says, oh, be a spokesperson for the soda industry, you'd be like, ooh, soda bad. Be a spokesperson for Coke. Coke, that's the fun one, right? Yeah.
It's a big brand. I'm going to be a big actor.
It's bright, like, and it's red, and everyone's smiling all the time.
All the
agents
will see me on the Coke commercial. Man.
And they'll be like, I want the guy from the Coke commercial. Yeah, I could see that.
No, but humans like to be associated into some tribe, and if a brands are often tribes, and they why do people wear like Tommy Hilfiger? Why did they used to? It's like they're associating with a tribe.
Yeah.
It's a make-believe tribe, but, you know, somebody's taking advantage of that.
I love cars. But every so often I'm going, why do I have a car that gets literally 15 miles per gallon? because look at the car. It's awesome. It's fast. It's cool. I love it. But also it gets 15 miles per gallon. So there's a cognitive dissonance in there where you have to squelch that voice that's telling you that what you're doing is bad, but it's so good.
I was doing this. I wanted to do this billboard that made fun of a Hummer, right? It said Jesus drove an SUV, Muhammad pumped his gas or whatever. And it had I'm at Kinko's like trying to blow up pictures of the Hummer to get a nice picture of the Hummer. And then, the woman behind the counter, and she was kind of cute, and she was like, oh my God, it's like, is that your Hummer? And she was ready to like marry me right then, because she was so impressed that like, this is a real man with a Hummer. And that's why you want a Hummer, because everybody's going to think you're really cool,
It was do you remember the early 80s movie? I think it was with Michael Keaton hires crazy people to, or was it Dudley Moore? They hired crazy people to run, I think it was called Crazy People, to run the ad agency. And it was like, you got to revisit this. Actually, this is well up your alley, because it's an insane asylum starts writing the ad copy, right? And one of them's like, Jaguar, that woman will sleep with you now, and stuff like that. You're hitting the nail on the head with that sort of like, this is how blatant we're getting manipulated. I'm going to show you. You don't even have to reveal the curtain. You just sort of turn on the light switch, and then the cockroaches scatter. That's sort of what you're doing with your art, which is awesome.
Well, and I think in the end, the Hummer went out of style, because, first people thought you were super cool if you had a Hummer, and then later when they realized it got 4 miles a gallon, that once they got laughed at, that was not the result they wanted from having a Hummer. They wanted people to think they're like awesome, they're adventure man. But when the society kind of turned on the Hummer and started making fun of it, then that's when everybody sort of got rid of their Hummers really quick,
Hitler's favorite actor was Charlie Chaplin. And then Charlie Chaplin made The Great Dictator, and which, has that iconic scene of Charlie Chaplin as Hitler bouncing the ball, the globe and stuff like that, and then giving that impassioned speech at the end. And Hitler shut down that portion of Charlie Chaplin and still maintained that he loved Charlie Chaplin, even though he made a movie explicitly mocking him. So mocking those in power, like your little Donald Trump Richie Rich, is great. I hope he knows that exists.
His financial advisor guy or whatever came to one of my shows and took a big stack of the money. We had like Donald Trump money.
Yeah.
It was like negative money, but whatever. But yeah, so I don't know if he knows or not. I've met him before, but I don't know what he knows and what he doesn't know.
You know what? He's probably so unself-aware, he'd probably love it. He'd probably be like, they're doing me as Richie Rich.
I'm that unaware too, because if he started calling me out like on his Twitter, like what a joke artist he is, blah, 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 nobody likes his art or whatever. Going, oh my God. Oh, that happened to my friend. She was like, Ron, this is going into the election. Please quit making fun of him. You're making him bigger. It's kind of having the opposite effect of your intention, and then a week later he called her out, and then she was all over, oh, Trump. I thought we weren't talking about him because we're just making him bigger by talking about him. It's like, yeah, but he called me out.
That's the new,
and he was so petty that he called out some LA artist.
That's the new street cred. Needle.
And so I'm sure that if Charlie Chaplin had made that same movie about him, he would say, got another movie about me.
Probably.
And he's not wrong. We dropped the ball by not knowing what to do at that moment. With Obama, we knew what to do. We promoted him. Like, I think the campaign actually tapped like 8 artists to work on this, some stuff. And then,
and then
a whole bunch of other street artists joined in, and it became a movement of, putting Obama everywhere, and it made him seem like the de facto winner. And then people felt comfortable voting for him, or whatever happened. It worked,
Was that a concerted effort?
Yeah.
It was.
It was a concerted effort, but he was not, he was pretty hands-off. I mean, they picked the first 8 artists, and then they sort of let it do its own thing, and he didn't really, they kind of, towards the end, they said, please, if you would just stay more positive, we're in the home stretch here, and they're like, yeah, they're calling you a terrorist. It's like, I think the time for positivity is over. It's time to attack back.
Right.
They're like, seriously, if you would just stay positive. Keep it positive. Don't make fun of the other candidates or, the other candidate. But, yeah, they were right. But we were, it didn't seem right. But, at the same time, he just sort of let us alone to do what we wanted to do. Like, what candidate would not want would let cease that kind of control, you know?
Right.
But he did remind me of Lincoln, because mine was like half Lincoln, half Obama.
Yes, yeah, yeah. You guys should definitely look
Lincoln
that up.
He kind of did the same thing. He goes, well, you know, he used to set aside time every day so people could come photograph him so that they could profit off of him. They could make a painting of him, or they could make an etching of him, or whatever they wanted to do. But he said, look, if I'm hanging on people's walls, then they're going to vote for me, you know? And it just works that way, you know? And then suddenly with Trump, you know, first we called the Hillary campaign and said, let's get, you know, the same crew together, and if we start coming out for her, I'm sure a lot of the other street artists will start coming out for him. We'll have a whole street art campaign for her. And they were like, we know who you are, and you backed the wrong person last time, and yeah, we got this.
Holy shit.
You know, and then you kind of like, obviously she would have been a better choice, but then, you know, you're still human and you feel like she just dissed us, you know, and she was so rude to us. And you shouldn't think that. You should think whoever's going to have the best policies for America. But, you really do fall into that kind of like,
yeah,
let things become personal. And so we just sort of, at least I decided, well, then I'm just going to make fun of Donald Trump. I'm not going to help you, you know.
You're right. That's the mechanism was petty.
Yeah.
The mechanism of the campaign apparatus was petty. They're like, oh yeah, we remember you from last campaign.
Yeah,
well,
he was a better choice.
Exactly. It's not a zero sum game. You know, there's shades of gray right here, dumbass.
But I'm embarrassed that I was that petty. You know, but we worked really hard for Bernie. <you know? laughs> And then they sort of threw him under the bus. And the irony is, like, I know a lot of people that, you know, especially a lot of people from my hometown and stuff are into Trump, like, big time, you know. And but I said, would you have voted for Bernie? He says, yeah, we liked him better.
Wait, what? No.
They wanted to throw a bomb in the, you know, in the room.
Yeah.
They wanted to blow up the horrible system that they feel left behind.
Yeah. So they either one would. Oh, wow.
Well, also, he's a genius. The guy is, I'm just slack-jawed. I've never seen, somebody so smart about, well, we know his old producer. And I said, is he a genius? And she looked at me like puzzled, like, are you kidding me? And then she thought for a minute, she goes, oh.
Yeah.
At manipulating the media, he is the smartest man on planet Earth.
Yeah,
nobody
absolutely
understands the media better.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, if you know, like, for me, it's interesting seeing the other side of it. It's like, well, here's a person that's bought into it. What is it about him you like? It's like, look, Ron, he's the imagery he created is brilliant. He came down from heaven. Now, what did he come down from? He came down from a penthouse. He came down from
the gold escalator.
Life.
Yeah,
he shits in a fucking golden toilet. Yeah. He screws whoever he wants. He does whatever he wants. He's untouchable. And then he came down into the muck that is our lives. And, man, people have been mean to him ever since. They spit on him. They yell at him. They make fun of him. He came down. He descended from the perfect life to save us. And you know what, Ron? He doesn't even take a salary. That's how in it for us he is. And
oh
then you
my
just
God.
Spit on him, man.
There,
you spit on him.
There,
and it's like,
wow.
It's, oh, my God, it's like biblical, you know.
There is
and it's hard to explain to him. It's like, no, he's actually making shit tons of money off the presidency. But, you know, I think that maybe people don't understand how he does that.
That was one of the best insights into the other half on how they would. I never even looked at it that way because, you know, we're New Yorkers. I'm like, yeah, came down from a shitty glass penthouse in fucking Fifth Avenue. Who cares? Yeah. Who wants that life in the first place? I'd come down from that life too.
Yeah. No, but he knew what he was doing. And I was a little puzzled at first. I mean, I knew he was going to win, but because he had this kind of hold on the Midwest and all these people that I used to know. But, you know, just the optics of it, it's like he's been running for president his whole life. Why would a guy like him go to pro wrestling? Because that's where the fans, that's his base. He got to him. He went to their thing. He brought the famous biker guy with the biker show up there and brought him to the lobby and let him put one of his motorcycles in the lobby for the guy's TV show. The guy has.
But
he reached out to all the right people and did the right things and showed them the right respect. And
for the past
and also like
40
you know,
years.
Yeah. And then, you know, people aren't, you know, we think, oh, we got him. You know, he's grabbing the pussies or whatever he's doing. It's like, but what they're hearing is he's David Lee Roth. He's a rock star. He does whatever he wants. You know, it's like he's the guy I want to be. They're not thinking he's a gross guy. I wouldn't want my daughter in the room with him. That's not what they're thinking. They're thinking, oh, my God, this just he tells it like he's a rock star. He just tells it like it is, do whatever he wants. He's the guy they want to be. And I don't think a lot of liberals saw that coming, you know.
God damn it.
Like, just leave it alone.
Now,
you know?
Now I sort of. Nope. I just went to a dark place. I'm coming out of it. Sorry. I'm coming out of it.
Well, you know they're going to lose again, right? He's going to do a landslide.
Probably. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Old retributions. Or what is it? Is it? Am I saying it right? The big issue now is like retributions or
what?
Fuck, I don't know.
Reparations.
That, they're hearing retributions.
No. There will be retributions. Yeah. For those who don't win, there will be retributions.
But there's a lot of ways that they could win easily. He's the easiest guy in the world to beat. You know, it's just they don't want to play it the right way, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, maybe everybody's benefiting so much that they just think, well, let's just let it roll for 4 more years and see what happens.
Then the total collapse of society. When it happens, I will be shored up in the Fortress English on the hills of Beacon. I'll man the machine gun nests.
I'm pretty sure that we'll be run out of the country. I'm trying to make a lot of friends in Canada. Yeah. Everywhere I go, I actually think that. I gotta be really nice to these people because I may be like, you know, on their doorstep going, please.
I heard.
It's not that easy to immigrate anywhere, really.
No, it isn't. Yeah. It isn't.
I think that's a myth that Americans have, that we're great Americans. Anybody would take us.
No, they won't. No, they won't.
China really hates us now. I'm getting really scared over there, you know.
What do you run afoul of the Chinese censors?
No. But I'm pretty careful. Yeah. This is my country. The reason I love this country is because we have this kind of dialogue. I mean, I think you achieve greatness through criticism. You know, I mean, I'm in the art world. We just tore each other apart. You know, but we all became better artists. So we weren't trying to really tear each other apart. We were just like raising the bar. You know, and I think criticism just raises the bar. And like, if somebody doesn't want to have, you know, a critical aspect to their culture, then their culture is going to atrophy, you know. So I love here, and, you know, I love it's the way it is. But I've never really much went, I mean, I have a little bit, but I haven't really went into a lot of other cultures and wreaked havoc in their cultures, because I feel like that's part of being American. It's just supposed to be critical to your country. And, you know,
also, you have to speak the language, not literally the language, yeah. but the language.
I've got into some trouble. I think I made fun of Theo Van Gogh once. You know, after he got stabbed. Well, I think they were. I thought you guys are making too big a deal of this. This is not your 9/11. They stabbed one guy. You know, it's not the same thing. I probably shouldn't have been saying stuff like that. In my defense, I was on live TV drunk. Okay, now how does that happen? Okay, so I'm having an art opening. It goes great. Kind of a weird afternoon because a lot of people had their fingers cut off, and it took me a while to realize, oh shit, they're on the mafia and they cut their fingers off. But they were buying the paintings, and it's all gone great. And at the end of the opening,
Wait, whoa! You can't just gloss over fingers cut off mafia guys buying your paintings.
Oh, my mother-in-law had come to the opening. It was in Amsterdam, and then she was going like, why does nobody have fingers? You know, they think they're all monsters. But they had disposable income, and so I was pretty happy.
Disposable fingers, apparently, too.
Yeah, well, if you don't pay, you lose a finger. But I paid. But at the end, I had just done an ad for Absinthe, which is a fake absinthe. And so the dealer says, I've got a bunch of the real absinthe, and I've got these 5 different bottles, and they're really good. And you know, the opening's over. Everybody's gone. You're just going back across the street to the hotel and going to sleep now. Would you like to sample the real stuff? So I did like 5 shots of different kinds of absinthe.
Yep.
And then as soon as it's over, then he goes, okay, well, we need to jump in the car now because you're on live TV in 20 minutes.
What?
So he didn't mention
5
that.
Shots
and
in.
That's how I ended up like being kind of drunk on TV. I remember being in the hall just before I went in, like chugging beers, trying to like sober up.
Wait, you chugged the beers to sober up?
Yeah.
I haven't been drunk on TV. But I've been... I've definitely been like had like a 5 a.m. call time on some certain shows before, and I'd been out the night before, and then I'd get home around like 1:32, and I'd be like, well, looks like I'm just staying up. So yeah. So I'd like coast through it, have no idea what I was talking about, not because I was drunk, but just because I was exhausted. And then, you know, they'd have the car to send me back home, and I'd fall asleep immediately in that car. And then everyone would text and tweet me, be like, oh, you were great on TV this morning. I'm like, I was on TV this morning? Oh my God, that was this morning, because it felt like so long removed.
Well, maybe like a shot of it. adrenaline went through you and sobered you up for the 15 minutes you're on TV.
I think that probably did it. That was probably what did it.
I remember I blacked out once on TV. Not from being drunk, just from being scared, you know? And then afterwards, I was like, oh my God, what did I say?
What did I do?
And then you watch it and goes, oh, that was funny. Okay. Thank God. It's nerve-wracking to be on TV, right? If you're not used to it.
No, and unfortunately, it's not for me.
Get a hangover? You don't?
No, it's bizarrely natural for me. It's like... It doesn't even faze me. I don't even notice the cameras or the lights. I just notice the person I'm talking to.
So you don't look in the audience and see every person you've ever known?
No, I see nothing. I see blank space. But, you know, I grew up, you know, playing in orchestras and, you know, stuff like that. So, like, I've sort of, in a way, always been on stage. I mean, being in an orchestra playing Twinkle Twinkle at age 4 is a little bit different than being on Good Morning America. But there's something translatable to that. Like, you know, I did sales. I worked as a barista. So like everything's sort of a stage for me. Like that's my performance, which is me being like happy-go-lucky, even though deep down inside I'm a very dark human being. I'm just kidding. I love myself. But that's the performative aspect for me that just was totally natural.
Some people have that and some people don't.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and when you first came over, you were talking about interviewing artists and sometimes they don't have a lot to say or they don't know how to talk about their work. And I think it's because most of them come from a place of being shy, and that's why they will gravitate to art, because it's a very lonely sport. You know, I'm famous for about 3 hours a year, and the rest of the time I'm just in my little studio all by myself, you know? So it's a very isolated life, you know? And yeah, it's interesting. I had a friend who was very charismatic, kind of like yourself, but he was also a really good painter, and he wanted to be a painter, but he could see it was driving him crazy. It was driving him crazy because you have to spend so many lonely hours, and he didn't want to be alone. He wanted to be with people, and finally he solved his problem by becoming an art dealer. So now his name's like on the gallery, and
he's involved
in art. He doesn't have to physically sit there and hand make all the paintings, but you know, it's kind of his art is putting together all these artists and curating artists into like shows and stuff. But now he's super happy because that's where he wants to be, where the action is.
Right.
But a shy person would think, oh my God, that's the hardest part is, you know, trying to sell this stuff, you know, making it, oh, that's fun, I can't wait. But, you know, when you throw me out in public, then I'm terrified, you know. And I'm a bit like that. You know, it's like I've done a lot of press because that helps sell the paintings. And I always feel like all this stuff is just buying me more time in the studio, you know.
Ah, that's a way to look at it. Yeah, you're sort of reverse engineering this is the poison pill I have to take before I get the sugar.
Yeah, or, you know, I think that a lot of artists don't realize that, you know, people don't know that much about art and that you do have to kind of sell it. And if they have questions, you should answer them, you know, and you should be, well, you know, I like bands like Kiss. I mean, they're not the greatest band, but they're grateful. You know, it's like, what's your favorite song? Oh, Rock and Roll All Night. Why? Because it sold the most and it keeps me on that stage where I want to be, you know?
Yeah. Was it Metallica when they came out with sort of a more poppier, I think it was the Black Album, which is 1991 or something like that. And they're like, what do you say to your old metal fans who say you've sold out? And one of them, probably Lars, goes, yeah, we sell out every fucking stadium we play. Like, you know, yeah. there's no shame in like, oh, I used to love them when they were the tiny little indie. Well, you know what they didn't love? Being the tiny little indie. They liked having, you know, they liked having the mansion and the Hummer and actually the meals and the mortgage, you know, because.
And the job security.
Yeah.
Because a lot of, if your band doesn't make it, and if you don't get like 3 hits or whatever the magic number is, then you're going to be selling cars, you know, which is nothing against selling cars. But it's like
if you wanted to be a rock star,
you're going to have hit songs. And that's why Gene Simmons is like, you know, that I love that song because it's sold, you know, that keeps us in the game. You know?
Ron, what's your Rock and Roll All Night? What's the reprint or the series or the limited series that's the hit that keeps your lights on?
Well, Guernica, almost every show. Like I did the one show because the guy had just opened in a new gallery and he needed a really successful show to kind of launch his new gallery or whatever. So it's kind of a thing. It's like, I want a Ron English Guernica. I want a Julian's novel plate painting. I want a Damien Hirst shark. Well, you know, Damien Hirst has made a lot of stuff. Yeah, but I want a shark. Yeah, but you can only get a tiny shark. I don't care.
I want the shark.
Yeah, I want the shark.
So, yeah, so people want the Guernica.
Maryland with Mickey's was a huge hit. You know, I had to kind of stop myself from painting that because at some point you could just do Maryland with Mickey shows, you know. But yeah, I've always looked at this as like a music career where, yeah, you have to do a little bit of crowd pleasing. You know, you have to make sure there's stuff in the show that's absolutely going to sell. You know, it takes people a while to simulate your new ideas. So like if you just did a show of everything's brand new, they can't handle it.
Right.
You know,
you got to play.
2 years later, they'll be like, I want that stuff.
You got to play Satisfaction and paint it black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you got to be grateful that you have that stupid song, you know. That song keeps you in business, you know?
Yeah, that's refreshing. When people ask for a new Ron English Guernica,
what happened with that is you know, at first it was I did a Guernica, right? And then I was happy, that's what I wanted to do. And then I thought of another idea with it. So I did that, and then one I kind of thought of three ideas and they were very similar, and I thought, well, I should gotta pick one and do that, and then I did all three. Just because I want to see what they all look like, done. And then at some point it became like a challenge. I thought, well, what would it look like from the airplane's point of view? Because they're kind of weird flat characters. What would they look like? What would it look like if it was an X-ray? You could see through them. You could see all the weird Picasso skeletons. So then it became a challenge. You know, and I think once I crossed 100, it was like, you know, how many ways can I do this before I'm burnt, you know? But now it's more of a challenge for me to see how many ways I can do it. And actually, before you came, I was sketching out a new thing and doing like, behind the walls and what's going on behind the walls.
Do you ever, you're like halfway through and you're like, why is this so, oh, I've done this one before.
Yeah, I played this song. But the challenge is to make it different every
like,
time.
Speaking things of wisdom. No, really? Oh, let's let it be. I did let it be again.
Yeah.
What's it take to commission a Ron English?
Money.
there we go.
But I'm also like weird because I do commercial stuff sometimes. I'm not opposed to it. I like the challenge. Interestingly with me, like what you talk about is some of my greatest hits. Like one of them was I have these two ladies and they're kind of like one's on top of the other, but when you look at them from the right angle, they're the Rolling Stones' tongue, you know. And that was an image I actually made because Jason Flom asked me to do it when he still worked with Mick, but I didn't come up with it right away. It took me about 8 months to come up with the image because he just said do something with the tongue so I could show it to Mick. And so by the time I came up with it, I think he had already left the label and Mick had left the label and he couldn't even talk to Mick anymore. But that painting existed and became a big hit, you know. But it became the hit because I wouldn't have just came up with it on my own. I was challenged to come up with something. He said, come up with something completely different with a tongue that nobody's ever thought of. You know, so it was issued to me as a challenge. And sometimes that works for me. Like the zipper banana was for the Dandy Warhols. And I said, you know, I was going to do their album cover. And I said, well, give me something to go on. And they said, well, we like the Velvet Underground. And we like Andy Warhol, obviously, because of our name. And so then it just instantly appeared in my head. You just take the banana and then the zipper from the sticky fingers
and you put them together and there you go. Yeah.
Simple, it'll work great. But I mean, I wouldn't have came up with that had they not tasked me to, you know, do that, you know? So I find getting challenges and taking on challenges, and sometimes it's a commission, you know, or sometimes it's maybe some commercial thing, but it opens me up to new ideas where I don't just stay locked in my same realm.
And if you do stay locked in and it's just like, I want to do something right now, blank sketch, where do you start?
Well, every day I wake up with different ideas, you know, and I jot them all down. So I have like thousands of ideas I'll never get to do. So usually I just pick one and say, okay, I want to see that one come to fruition, you know.
See if it flies.
Or just, I want to see what it looks like, you know, finished. I'm going to get it out of my brain and I'm there.
Oh, you're curious. I'm like, yeah. Is this going to work?
Well, it's kind of like your dreams. It's like, well, tell me about your dream. It was kind of foggy and weird, but I mean, there was definitely stuff in there. But yeah, I don't know. Like sometimes you actually just dream something. Yeah, I had a funny dream and I was in a museum and I saw a painting and I thought, that's really a clever idea. Man, I wish I would have thought of that idea. And I kind of didn't like that artist because it's like, damn, I should have thought of that idea. That's so easy. I should have thought of that idea. And I woke up and I was kind of angry because, you know,
it was in the
dream.
That
should have been my idea. You
right.
Know? It's like, I got to come up with an idea like that. And it took me like about 5 minutes to realize it's like, that artist doesn't exist.
It exists
inside your head.
It was your
he
idea.
He made that painting. And it, I mean, but I still feel like I was stealing the idea because I was stealing it from this artist in my head. What's an interesting thing is where do ideas come from? You know, and I don't understand the human brain that well, but like one of my friends has written hit songs and she goes, you know, I've actually never written a hit song. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, I write songs every day. I channel the hits. And I understood exactly what she was talking about. It's coming from somewhere else, and you're just the vehicle for it. You know?
Oh,
the
yeah. Vessel, oh, yeah, absolutely. When I was writing music, because I have a classical music degree, and I wrote, like, you know, singer-songwriter songs. I was in the village with a harmonica, and yeah, and girls don't like me. Guess where that went? Nowhere.
They started laughing. Yeah, my friend wrote this whole album about how girls hated him, and I'm like, now you got a girlfriend. So is your career over? And it was.
It was? Yeah. No. I'd be sitting there with my guitar and, like, you'd just vomit out the song fully formed, like Athena sprung from Zeus's head. Like, everything was there. The melody was there. The harmonica was there. The chords were there. And then the words just came, and you're like, did I just write what I think in my, for my skill set is, or skill level, a pretty damn good song in 34 seconds. Like, I wrote the song faster than the actual existence of the song is. I get that, at least with the musical.
And it seems like the greatest stuff comes that easy.
Yeah.
You know? And the rest of the stuff is just work, you know?
Right, right. Like, you know, Mozart just went, there's a symphony.
Right.
Beethoven's, Mozart's manuscripts are perfect. You look at them, there's not, everything is perfect. Yeah. Beethoven's manuscripts, erase. Huh. Ink blotted out, stains on it.
Well, you probably know this, because they asked Einstein, like, how did you come up with the theory of relativity? And he more or less said, and I'm badly paraphrasing, but he more or less said, well, that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think he put all that information in his head, and then it sort of probably came at its own time.
Right, 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 right. It was there, ready to be plucked from the ether. All the building blocks were there.
He had to prime his brain to have that thought.
Yeah, yeah. He said the answer was always there. I just had to, think
take a
about
shower.
pretty much. It's so fascinating how these three, you know, in fact, any discipline, like that genesis of the idea, where does it come from and how it manifests itself in different disciplines and how it manifests itself in different personalities, like those who have to struggle to work at it and those who have the bolts of lightning. And I guess the key to success in almost any creative endeavor is balancing the two, like harnessing the bolt of lightning, but then refining and crafting it. Because if you don't, you won't have the next bolt of lightning. It won't be just there ready to be thought of.
Right. Now, I do a lot of music, but I don't know how to play any instrument except drums. But I was talking to my friend. I was very frustrated. I hear all these great songs in my head, and he goes, who cares? If you can't get them out, who cares? You know, that's when I learned how to work with musicians and, you know, and make things happen. And so whatever was in my head now exists, you know. And it was interesting for me because, again, you know, like with my painting and stuff, it's very hands-on. It's a different approach. But, like, Jeff Koons doesn't touch anything.
No.
No, but those giant balloon dogs would not just magically exist without his you take everybody in the equation that worked on that.
Yep.
And you could pull out any one of those people except Jeff. You know, he's the one driving force. If he's gone, those balloon animals cease to exist. Maybe if the guy that sanded him, if you pull him out, or if you pull out one of the studios that worked on it, then he just would go to another studio. But they exist because of him. And it's interesting because he takes the exact opposite approach that I do. You know, it's not like hands-on, and every little smudge isn't his. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do music, I'm going to approach it that way. So, and I'm not even going to learn an instrument because I'm going to use other people the way he uses other people. So I'm going to approach music the way he approaches art.
I understand. Yeah. I mean, that's how some modern composers operate. Back in the day, to compose, you had to be schooled in various, ideally multiple instruments.
Right.
But now there's modern contemporary composers whose only language is the computer. Now, therefore, because that, they can manipulate instruments per how they want to without ever having touched one.
Right.
And they make some damn good music from it.
Yeah.
So I don't see any harm in being like Jeff Koons. I mean, I'm not really a fan of Jeff Koons, but I don't see any harm in that style of art because everyone thinks the Warhol factory and the Koons factories and the Hearst factories, they're all like, that's not really art. Well, guess what? Rembrandt only painted like one third of Rembrandt's. He'd do the faces and then he'd hand it off, you know?
That concept wasn't...
It's not really, new, yeah.
But the concept of, I'm going to have a portrait studio, I'm going to make a portrait that's going to look like in a certain style, and nobody, I don't think anybody went there expecting him to paint it. You went there to get a portrait that would look a certain way, and that was his brand.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think the idea of that the lone individual was like almost invented by Van Gogh, or do you know what I mean?
It
came later.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of them, the Donatellos, right. The Da Vincis, they all had. Yeah, there was no lone. I mean, right. I mean, obviously, like their sketches and their sketchbooks. Yeah, that's their lone right. wolfness. But their major masterpieces are done with the armies.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's
but you know, to me, it's kind of like I like. You know, I'm kind of locked into what I'm doing with painting. And it, like if Mark Ryden, you know, got a team of people to paint those, I don't think that his career would, I think it would probably fall apart pretty quickly because people kind of know that's him personally just touching every square inch of that painting and mothering it into existence. But, you know, like, but I also want to have the experience of being a different kind of artist, you know, and you were talking about like being in other countries or China and I act completely differently there. And I actually come at it from the other way. It's like I try to not offend or do anything wrong, or do you know what I mean? I became almost the opposite person than I am here.
Mm-hmm.
Just to have that experience of what it's like not to be the rebel all the time, not to be pushing against everything, you know, not questioning everything. But
right. Well, there's also something.
Well, there's also
something really presumptuous assuming that you can act out in someone else's culture. That's sort of. I mean, that's gauche to me. You know. Oh, I can act out in my own culture. Because I'm fluent in it.
Right.
But if I'm going to someone else's, I have no right to criticize your, you know, culture. Now, when I get back to the USA, I will criticize your culture. But I don't have any right to do it while I'm in there. I'm not the insider. That's why you have your protesters and your artists to, you know, right. extrapolate the grievances, the internal grievances of your culture. I can't do that. Yeah.
But it's also interesting to get to deal with the top people in the society and the lowest people in the society
yeah.
to see what everybody's thinking. Because also I always thought, in a weird way, nobody's wrong. And nobody self-identifies as a jerk. You know, nobody's the bad guy in their own story, in their own narrative, in their head. It's like, you know, so like if you're the president of a country and things are going wrong, you know, you're going to have to deal with this in some way. And it may not be, you know, the way that people want you to or, you know. But you're given a problem and you have to solve it a certain way. And maybe, you know, people that don't have that problem don't have to really think about how do you deal with that. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if I'm making any sense or not.
You know, you're
it's
making
interesting. If you look at
you're making
like,
too much sense.
There's nobody trying to be the bad guy, you know,
and again, except Canadians.
Again, I think I'm the good guy. And the whole time that I did all those billboards, I committed over 1,000 felonies.
Yeah.
So, you know, by law, I'm a bad guy.
Right.
But
in your own story.
Cigarette ads. I was thinking, you know, I'm taking out all these cigarette ads so the kids don't see them. And maybe there's 11 people that are adults now that don't smoke because of me. And that's worth that, you know. But again, am I rationalizing or is that, you know, I mean, I always thought it was moral, but I wasn't always legal. You know what I mean?
Moral, but not always legal. Correct.
And sometimes
yeah.
people like the laws because, you know, I can be as amoral as I want as long as I don't cross out of the law zone. You know, as long as it's tacitly legal, then it's okay to do. But is it, you know?
Right. I can run a savings and loan fund into
right.
the ground.
Because it's not
legal,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I have a feeling that we've probably lost 97% of our listeners, but I don't care because...
I don't believe we ever had them.
No, we definitely had it. At a certain point in time. There was a 100%, and now we've lost 97% of that 100%. So
now I can say what the winning lottery number is
yes,
for next week?
It's okay. Seven. Yeah,
Seven's in there.
Seven's in there. There's yeah. definitely a seven. Ron English, this has been absolutely fascinating. I have the psychic telekinetic feeling that we're going to have another conversation in the near future. This has been immensely entertaining.
There'll be beer involved in the next.
You know what? The next one, yeah, let's have
a
couple
more
beers.
Fun when we have beer.
Yeah, I think we'll have a lot more fun. We'll have a couple beers.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ron English. Thank you, Ron.
Oh, thank you so much.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.